But I do feel like what I have done in my life is to take both the temperament and the skills in terms of research that I got from my dissertation work, my graduate work, and to use that to think about, I don't know, questions that really matter to me and that I think matter to a wider audience, to be able to say, here are these questions that I have about why do we have these expectations about mothers and where do they come from and what is the history of that? And I'm really interested in, and I do think this is kind of the core of what I want to do and where I'm going. What are the common places, the received wisdom, the ideas that just feel like common sense? How can we unpack that and maybe have better ideas? And that's the kind of work that I really like reading and researching and writing.
I'm your host, Caitlin Salamini, and this is the Postpartum Production Podcast. Here, we hold conversations about the intersection of caregiving, creative practice, and capitalist production, as well as what it means to be producing art while also being a parent in modern society. Find out more at www.postpartumproduction.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. This episode feels deeply personal and interpersonal to me. Nancy Reddy has been a friend for the entirety of my youngest child's lifespan, which is to say, I've known her for a lifetime, even if it was someone else's. Funny the way we tend to view our new friendships against the ages of our kids once we have them, no? Anyway, Nancy and I met when her anthology, The Long Devotion, Poets Writing Motherhood, was published a few years ago. And you can hear that podcast interview in season 1, episode 12, which also features her co-editor, Emily Perez. Nancy is a writer and a writing teacher at Stockton University in New Jersey. A published poet, she has 3 books of poetry under her belt, no small feat. Her first book of narrative nonfiction, The Good Mother Myth, was published with St. Martin's Press in January of this year. She's also recently written pieces on the damaging mythology of the golden hour after birth for Slate and Making Mom Friends for Romper, as well as review essays on the whiteness of the motherhood memoir and the political nature of motherhood at Electric Literature. I am deeply grateful for all of Nancy's work and personally grateful that Nancy lives close to my in-laws in the greater Philadelphia area. So every time I'm in town, we find our way to what has become our regular coffee shop meetup and catch up on writing, motherhood, and life. Yet today's interview actually took place in Los Angeles during the Association of Writing Programs Conference Week. We were both in town there and held an in-person interview, one of my favorite settings for obvious reasons. In this interview, we dive deep into Nancy's personal relationship with motherhood myths in modern American society and how she came to transition from writing poetry to writing a very research-driven nonfiction memoir. I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing from her experiences as much as I did. So here we go. I am really excited to be able to sit with you. And after also being at your event last night, I was thinking I had all these questions that were burning, but I figured I didn't want them answered. I didn't want to have to have stale content today, at least for me. And obviously, we've known each other for... Wait, did we meet through Amanda Montes? How did we meet?
We met because I remember so clearly the Pocket Universe and Long Devotion were coming out. And I was looking for podcasts and trying to be in conversation with people. And I came across Postpartum Production. I remember so clearly driving to the grocery store, listening to the very first episode. I think it was even just like your intro. And I was like, oh my goodness, this person is asking all of the questions that I'm obsessed with in terms of what is productivity? How do we think about creative production outside of capitalism? Like all of these things. And no, I just pitched myself to you. I was like, hi, I want to be on your podcast.
I was going to say, I remember this differently. I remember a friendship. And I'm like, I have no, that's so sweet.
We did that interview. And then I think I must have known Amanda's work. You mentioned Amanda Monte. I must have known her work also. And then you invited me to be part of the writing group. And that was how I got to know Minna. So I think we realized, oh, we actually have all of these overlapping interests and connections. But yeah, no, that was just me boldly reaching out because I love this podcast.
Thank you. Because I did not know that story. And I love hearing that. There was this incredible conference a week ago at the Museum of Motherhood in Florida. Did you hear about this? The University of Florida. So I did a virtual presentation. And when I was on the Zoom presentation, a woman who was local to the organization came on and said, I've been listening to your podcast for a few years. And I was like, what? Oh, cool. I guess you guys are out there. So thank you to anyone listening today. But obviously, so we have a lot to talk about. We've talked in the past about the work that you put out a few years ago and the long devotion and the anthology. And this season is a season about birth. So not to belabor the subject, but I'm curious because having known you now for a bit, I feel like I've seen a number of interesting rebirths in your life in terms of who you are and what you do and your interests. And so would love to hear from you how that concept resonates with you and how you would define what that means in terms of your creative life and your caregiving and all of it.
Yeah, I feel like I'm in this really interesting, in terms of my writing life and I think broader professional life, where I spent a lot of years trying to figure out how to move into prose. I was trained as a poet, I was trained as an academic, and I really had this vision of wanting to write a nonfiction book that would reach a wider audience. Had to learn how to do that kind of writing, had to learn all of the practical stuff that goes with that. Like, how do you find an agent? How do you pitch essays? How do you do all of those kinds of things? And not that I've done those things, but like I did in a practical sense, publish this book. And now I feel like I'm at this moment of, ooh, what is the next thing? So maybe it's like a afterbirth kind of, not afterbirth, but like, what is the next thing? And trying to figure that out. I've been talking to and thinking with Tracy Gee, who was at the event last night too, who wrote a really great book called The Magic of Knowing What You Want. And so I feel like I've really been trying in the spirit of that book, try to listen to myself to think, well, what is it that I want now? What do I want to be doing in my creative life and in my professional life? So I'm not sure how that connects to birth, but it's kind of like, what is the next thing, I guess?
In terms of the writing that you do, because poetry, and we had a conversation about this last night, but every form comes with its own constraints and possibilities. How do you define yourself right now? And not that we have to be, you know, unilaterally a poet, or what does that mean to you? And how do you bring your background and the work that you have done, especially given, you know, and you talk so much about this in the book, your dissertation and all the work that you were doing, and especially in terms of critical theory and all these things, and now looking at where you are, how do you put those pieces together and where do they fit?
Yeah, I'm laughing because I had a very funny to me conversation recently with my dissertation advisor. I was just in Wisconsin like 2 weeks ago. And he's lovely and will not listen to this, I don't think, though he did. He shows up in the book for like a minute and he wanted to talk to me about it and it was awkward. An incredible mentor. But I said something about, oh, I was in the archives. I was doing some research for this new project that I'm really excited about. So we were talking about that. And he was like, oh, yeah. And there was this, it was the same different set of archives, but I had done my dissertation was archival as well. And he was like, that was good research. You should publish some of that. And it made me realize, oh, A, I did. And I don't think he knows that. And B, for someone who's a serious scholar in the way that he is, that's how you get to be a real whatever. Because I published this book, which is trade nonfiction, it's not a real, like, it just was funny where I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I am not doing the kind of scholarship that I was trained to do, which obviously I know, but it was funny to see that reflected back to me. But I do feel like what I have done in my life is to take both the temperament and the skills in terms of research that I got from my dissertation work, my graduate work, and to use that to think about, I don't know, questions that really matter to me and that I think matter to a wider audience, to be able to say, here are these questions that I have about why do we have these expectations about mothers and where do they come from and what is the history of that? And I'm really interested in, and I do think this is kind of the core of what I want to do and where I'm going. What are the common places, the received wisdom, the ideas that just feel like common sense? How can we unpack that and maybe have better ideas? And that's the kind of work that I really like reading and researching and writing, which is in a way taking, I think, the habits of scholarly research and then bringing a creative writing brain to it to reach people who aren't going to read the scholarly journals that my dissertation director maybe thinks I should be publishing in.
You had me thinking about last night, again, our conversation over dinner with your friend Angela, who's also an incredible poet, and in the way that she was discussing her questions and using poetry as the framework, building a bridge between those questions and some exploration of what the answers may look like. I'm wondering now, from your perspective, especially given you've worked in different genres, why the leap to nonfiction? Or could you see yourself answering those questions in different genres? And what would that look like?
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like Pocket Universe and The Good Mother Myth are in a lot of ways cousins, maybe the prose poetry companions to each other. And some of that I was doing consciously. And I must have been writing them to some extent at the same time. It came out, 3 years apart, but there must have been overlap in terms of working on them. And I think there are some parts of it where I was intentionally like, oh, here's this poem that I wrote about Harry Harlow. What if I spend 10,000 words thinking about Harry Harlow? Like, that's a real, and I don't think I actually have 10,000 words about him in there. Maybe I do, though. He's an important part of the book. And so some of it, I think, practically is just the space that you have in prose that you don't have in poetry. I think what poems can do, and we were talking about this a little bit yesterday in terms of surrealism, but maybe not quite surrealism. What poems can do, I think, is to try to say a really deep, mysterious thing in a kind of indirect way. I'm trying to think if that makes sense or not. Whereas I've had to learn in nonfiction to actually just spell the thing out a little bit. And it's made me think about some of my habits in poetry. Like, maybe there are moments in my poems where if I were to revisit it, oh, I don't know. What did I do? Did I get to an ending and just do kind of like a jazz hands? Like, you figure it out, reader. Whereas in nonfiction, you do actually just have to spell out, this is what I think this means. I was thinking this and now I think this. And I was really resistant to that feedback the first many, many, many times I got it, because I think the expectation in poetry is that a reader does that work. And I've come to really love actually getting to have those moments of argument and reflection in nonfiction. And it's just a very different way of thinking, I think, on the page.
Is it not, though, then a little bit more of that academic brain in the academic format? You cannot jazz hands it.
Yeah, right. Let me drop a quotation in and then you figure out what I mean by it. Yeah, no, I think you're probably right about that. Yeah, that's really helpful because I don't think I had thought about it that way. I think, again, like the first several times I got that feedback in essays or in drafts, I felt like I don't want to have to spell it out for my reader, right? I don't want them to think that I'm talking down to them. But I think the way I have come to think about it, which is more accurate and probably also more generous, is I am sharing my thinking with you on the page. And in some cases, I actually just had to think more myself. And I think when it's personal narrative in particular, oh, part of why I was doing the jazz hands was maybe I haven't really thought through what this means or what was happening or whatever in the same kind of way. So in some cases, it's academic writing. In some cases, it's just actually deeper personal work to be able to reflect in a more precise way the thing that I'm talking about.
You had me thinking about something that came up last night at the event at Zippy's Bookshop, which was, you said early on with your agent, the book had a different, I don't know if it's a different format or different focus, and that they helped you to shift that. And given that this is about birth, I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the birth of the book and where the birth story changed trajectory and you had to go with the new process.
Because I started working on this book in 2018. So a lot of that is like, we've all been through a lot since 2018. So I don't think it's wrong that it's that long, but I had to learn a lot. And I also really had to figure out what a book can do and be and contain. And it started out, I think, trying to be kind of a theory of everything about motherhood. I would say the thing that I really learned from my agent that I'm still trying to learn has to do with simplicity and clarity, and that actually, and this is another thing that I think she said to me 3 or 4 times before I could really hear it, There's 7 chapters in the book. Each chapter more or less focuses on one researcher. The number of times she had to suggest that to me before we finally got there, because I really had to rethink the structure. You know, I had this narrative thread. I had all of these ideas. I think by the time that I signed with her, I had gotten into being, okay, it's about this core of attachment theory and where that research comes from. And she very gently, well, what if each chapter focused on da da da? And I don't think it was like she knew the answer and she was not pushing me directly enough towards it. She was, I think, probably suggesting other things as well. But I think the misconception that I had was that because I had a lot of complicated, nuanced ideas, the structure needed to be complicated. And the opposite is actually true. Once I had a simpler structure, then I was able to figure it out. And I have in my office at home, which is also our guest bedroom, we have a big wall that's just blank. And there were so many versions of the book that were on that wall with index cards and post-it notes and things. And once I got to, here's the chronological, here's the narrative section of it. And then here are the different researchers and what each one is going to help me to talk about. Then I could figure out that structure. Because there's stuff like, oh, okay, I knew halfway through the book, my son starts going to daycare. And that changes my work life, changes my relationship to parenting, was honestly such a blessing. And okay, Mary Ainsworth and her research on the strange situation, that goes right there. Once I had that simple structure, like I'm going to have a Mary Ainsworth chapter, then I could figure out how to put those things in that sequence. Yeah, but it had to be simple so that each chapter could then contain complicated ideas.
That's really interesting and helpful for me as a reader of this book, because to me, it seemed almost obvious. Like it fit so well, not in an obnoxiously perfectly tied up way, but in a really lovely complement, right? To have that personal framework and then the more academic meatier, well, not that the personal can't be meaty, obviously, but in that sort of denser intellectual investigation that was happening with each researcher. It's interesting to hear that that was a later moment for you.
I think once you figure out a structure like that, it feels like, oh, of course, of course. I don't even remember what I was trying to do before that. I just have a lot of index cards with a lot of ideas on them and different studies. And once I figured that out, things really clicked together in a lot of ways.
One thing that I wanted to take a moment to look at was, especially just in relationship to caregiving and to parenting, is obviously the subject matter of attachment, the research and the basis for so many recommendations, if you will. I think for me personally, what I really enjoyed in your book is that there's so much of the attachment universe that I was really drawn to. And I don't know if it was, I had such a long, we have talked about this in the podcast before, but such a long fertility journey that getting to become the parent that I did really genuinely want to be, for me, parenting and motherhood is just one experience of life. Like we can have different ways of living and being in the world. And it was something that I always felt like I knew I wanted to experience. And not having that for so long and then having it, I think it fit so well for me. I just wanted to be in it so deeply because it had been so held from me. And I was witnessing so many friends and people that just fell into it so easily. And it was really hard. And it wasn't like I wanted to force myself into wanting it that badly, but I genuinely really wanted that physical closeness that comes with a lot of those practices. Now, that's not to say, right, that that's what then makes a better parent or a better child. That was what I was leaning into. And yet, I felt like, interestingly, so much of the trajectory of your book and where you come to as a person and as an academic thinker was very similar to mine, where over time, the more I learned about alloparenting, the more I was like, oh, this is what I want. I want to carry my kid on my back. And I want to say, I'm tired of carrying my kid. You can carry my kid now. And that's sufficient too, right? Navigating that, it just felt so alleviating to see examples. Yeah. I think I read, it's definitely controversial, but the continuum concept, you remember that sort of work? And then talking to Darcia Narvaez and seeing the work that she's done as well on similar subject matters and you kind of care in community, I felt like was so eye-opening, but also eye-opening and terrifying at the same time, right? Because I feel like even in talking last night, I was thinking a lot about what
Ruth Whipman was saying about, I think she was talking about helicopter, like that tension between my kids are going to be fine, I'm going to like be hands off, and then this need to be close and be watching. And I actually found that helicopter parenting is a symptom of our dysfunctional society, in that it is a need to care for deeply for a child that is not being cared for by anyone other than you. Right? Yes. Meaning there's no social safety net. There's no community. You walk out into the community, no one cares about your kids. In fact, they're a huge inconvenience to capitalism and to all of what we're building in this type of society. And so I just have often felt like there's so much of this blame falling on the individual, when the real blame is the structural and the social. And so seeing those opportunities for example, in the example that you give in Margaret Mead, was so riveting. And I was like, oh my God, she's so ahead of her time too. And how did she do that? What sort of privileges existed? Yeah. But then also what sort of template could be used there? Yeah. What other opportunities for care? And I think we see it in, if we were just talking about polyamorous communities as well, of looking at different ways of care. And I think it's so, again, I think the word that just keeps coming to mind is alleviating of this pressure on the nuclear family is unreal. And I don't even know where I'm going with that, but mostly, I guess if you could take anything away from what you've learned in this book and in your work of how we can move beyond these very intentionally, in terms of the system, siloed units that bear the brunt of all this caregiving onus, and shift that broadly. Is that policy? Is it, I mean, maybe it's all of it, but I'm just kind of curious what you see.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's like an incredible, that is the question, right? Is what do we do about this? And I feel like the pandemic made so clear for me something that I think had been clear, right? Like, even two parents is not nearly enough parents. It's just, we all need more adults and more people. And then I think suddenly when we didn't have access to any of that, it just really, for me, transformed my life actually in a lot of ways. So I was just in Wisconsin and did a book festival event with Jessica Calarco, who's a sociologist who wrote the book Holding It Together. And she was giving me a very lightly hard time about a joke that it's a line and it is an observation about, oh, we can't, you know, the research on childcare policy shows and the gender wage gap, we can't solve all of our problems by going to Sweden because the gender wage gap persists, even though they have very egalitarian policies. Women's rate of employment is still slightly lower after they become mothers, et cetera, right? So like actually even these Scandinavian countries that look, and they are better, right? But she was like, don't you think that policy matters? I was like, well, of course policy matters. I think I was in like a little moment of despair when I wrote that and like, man, I can't just become Swedish and that'll fix all my problems. But the conversation that we ended up having was about, in the US, or maybe my brain, but I don't think it's just me, we can think about ourselves as individual actors and individual families. And then we think at the level of policy. And I think because especially right now, I just feel like, will anything productive happen in terms of policy in the next 4 years? I don't have a lot of hope for that. I do have hope for some local and state level stuff. That's where I'm trying to spend my energy when I can. But I think that we forget sometimes when the policy feels so hopeless, and we know we're not getting that support, the answer oftentimes is to try, as you were saying with helicopter parenting, right? To try to crunch down into our own homes, right? And to do everything we can with our kids and for our kids, to get the most for our kids. I think there's actually another answer that is in between, which is we can build structures of support between our families. And I think it's easier to do this now that my kids are a little bit older, or maybe it's just easier for me because I'm in a different place in my life. But even just little things like, oh, we can carpool, right? We have like a walk-in carpool with one of our neighbors a couple days a week. And that is both practical help because her mom has to be at work a little bit earlier than is possible with the school schedule. But it's also, it just means that I'm like texting my neighbor a couple days a week that I wouldn't have otherwise. And that's such a small example, but those small ways that we can look out for our neighbors, I think do really matter. It's not the same thing as having affordable childcare, but it makes our house a little bit more porous too, right? I think so often our house becomes a little bunker and it's like, well, if Madeline is in my house a couple mornings a week, that does actually change the way that I think about it and the way that I think about my neighbors. And so I feel like I'm really in a place right now of trying to look for more opportunities to do that kind of work and relationship building, really.
I really appreciate that. And I think I'm in a very similar frame of mind. You have me thinking that we have someone who lives near us that we've connected with, and they are a single parent to a young child and have a dog. And my daughter's obsessed with animals. And so we've found this lovely equilibrium of the dog can come. Like, we just text to like, oh, can the dog come over? Okay, the dog can come over. The dog's gonna come over for a few hours. Again, I love that idea of the porousness of the home, that it's not these walls that keep us in, but that they're open and that they can contain so much more than just our family unit. And I think also, yeah, that sort of falling back on knowing who you can count on. And I think American society being, I don't know where this comes from, and I'd be curious if you know, or if anyone would be able to point me to better resources, but this idea of kind of like a tit for tat, right? It's like, well, I took your kid for that sleepover, so therefore this balancing out, or like, I paid for dinner that one time, so you're going to pay the other, right? I don't know how much of that is cultural. And I just feels like I don't want that. And I don't know how to define, like, do you say that explicitly, right, to these relationships that you have where you're like, by the way, I'm cool with it. But also obviously you have boundaries around, you can't always be the home that accepts everyone. But what does that look like to navigate in terms of care? And how do you know who are your emergency contacts in a village when like the village is not your extended family anymore?
It's one of the things that I think has been really hard for me about asking for help of any kind, especially with my kids, is not wanting to owe someone something that I can't repay in quick order, right? That it's not like I take the kids today, you take them tomorrow, right? That it's been hard for me to think about just a kind of reciprocity where no one's keeping a ledger. One of the things that really helped me to think about this actually is a good friend of mine, my best friend from college, who she used to live in Long Beach, and she was instrumental or was like part of setting up a time bank there where neighbors would exchange different kinds of things. Like, oh, I can mow someone's lawn. They put money in the bank or time in the bank. And that worked really well there. And then she moved back to Philadelphia and has been trying for years with a community organization to get a similar time bank set up in her neighborhood in Philly. And she realized at one point that it just, because people were thinking about this ledger and nobody wanted to owe anybody else, it kind of wasn't going. And she realized that they needed to reframe the whole thing and to understand before they're even trying to exchange stuff like tasks and help, that they like that what they, the actual work of the organization had to happen before that, which was that they were talking about what people needed and what other people could offer. And I thought that was just so profound as a form of community building, that even saying this is what I need is actually how you build community, or these are the things that I think I can do, because it is a hard thing to understand. And it seems so small-minded, but I do think it's in American culture of I'll do this for you, or you'll do this for me, but don't worry, I'll get you back. And it feels much better to have relationships with neighbors that are like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, send him over, like send that kid over or do whatever, where you're not counting, but it's kind of like an I am giving what I can give and then you give back what you can give and we trust that it will shake out.
That actually leads quite well into a question that I had, and you had mentioned about this podcast specifically in terms of capitalism and production, right? In terms of how we determine and quantify what that looks like. And that creative pursuit obviously sits so much outside of the constraints of what a normal capitalist model would ask of that product. And your Substack, which is Write More, Be Less Careful, which I love as a title, you know, I've seen you really wrestle with a lot of those questions. So also in your book, I also noticed that there was a lot of Nancy energy in terms of, you were talking a lot about, especially in early motherhood, feeling like you weren't getting ahead, like someone else would like get ahead of you. And I was very interested and intrigued by just that idea of this race. And I'm like, where are we racing to, Nancy? Right? Like, where are we going? And so in thinking of where you are now and what you're writing about in terms of that subject matter, I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I always think about the Jenny O'Dell question of productivity that produces what for whom. And I mean, I do think in graduate school, I was not wrong. I don't think there is a scarcity of academic jobs, for example, of books and articles that are going to get published, right? And I was very tuned into that. And I do think, you know, I raced through my PhD, and if I had graduated another year or two later, like, would I have gotten a job? I don't know. So actually, it was not functional for me. Like, it was not helpful maybe for my mental health and happiness at the time, but I was responding accurately, I think, to the incentives in the system. That said, I mean, I think now about, and in some ways it's a position of privilege. I don't have a fancy job, but I do have a secure job, which is not nothing, you know, at a regional public where I'm tenured and we're unionized. And, you know, as much as anything is safe in this country right now, I think I'll continue to have a job. And that gives me an amount of just security where I can think like, oh, okay, where is the next thing? What is it that I want to do next? To be able to uncouple from some of the hustle that was really driving me in those years. That said, though, I don't know. It is hard to escape the feeling of other people are getting ahead of me, or look at the volume of publications or the sales numbers or whatever. I mean, I think as much as I don't want to, and I don't measure the value of my writing in terms of sales, like that is also just a part of, I mean, it's capitalism, right? Like we can try to think ourselves outside of capitalism, but it is still the world and country and economic system we live in.
Okay. I just keep thinking, you're making me think about my book that I'm working on right now, where I'm like, I don't want to have to sell it. And I don't want to. We were talking about the ownership and the authorship of being in relationship with that product.
Well, and I wrote something in the newsletter a little while ago that I keep having to remind myself of, which was about marketing versus making art. And I was talking about the example of Shark Tank and how like, the products that do really well in Shark Tank are often things that shouldn't exist, actually. Like, they're not good. They're not helpful. They're just well marketed. And that I think that's actually a really important reminder for writers. And it's one that I, just to be totally honest, in the season of my writing life where the book is kind of newly out, need to remind myself of, that making a good thing and selling it are actually totally different processes. And that, I don't know. At this point, I think as writers, our job is to do both of those things, or maybe, right? Like you can choose to take up the marketing or not, but it's very hard not to take up some portion of it. But the commercial success of a book is only one measure of the success. If the book does not sell well, that doesn't actually retroactively make the book itself worse, which is such an obvious thing to say, but I do think it's, for me, it's something that I keep having to tell myself, and that I think is probably, I don't know, maybe also other people need to hear it. Sales are not actually an assessment of the value of a book, even though it can easily feel like that.
So I'm staying right now at a very good friend from college's home, and she has an amazing library of books. And I noticed in her bookshelf, this book that, so when my book, my one book that was published, was a finalist for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, which was also one of those things where I was like, what? Like, I don't understand why, but okay, cool. So subjective too, in terms of, okay, well, one person happened to like my work. And if in other formats or other prizes or other committees, my book would not have had the same reception. Fine. And recognizing that and seeing that randomness and happenstance of it. But I noticed on my friend's shelf, one of the other finalists, the book was there. And I was like, oh my God, did you read this book? And she said, no, actually, I haven't read it yet. And I was like, why do you have it? Where did you come across it? Because it was actually, I think it was published by a smaller press, and it wasn't as big of a splash as potentially some of the others that were also finalists with me. And she said, oh, I don't know, maybe I saw it when your book, when that came out, and I must have, and I was intrigued by it, and I bought it. And I loved that book, and it didn't win. And the book that did win, I didn't love as much. Yeah. And just to see what are the decisions in that process, right? And obviously from a sales perspective, winning, I would assume, increased the sales, right? And so it's like the subjectivity of just even one committee to determine what is, quote, the best book. It's like the whole process to me feels so flawed even in that, right? It's like such a strange thing because we all find an audience. There's always, looping all the way back to you know, the beginning of this conversation in terms of this podcast, right? It's not going to work for everyone. And yet there are those individuals for whom it does work. Capitalism wants everything to be like watered down into the thing that works for the most people, but in like the least useful way, in like the least deep and meaningful way. It has to be the most superficial way. And you look at like TikTok and all the rest of it, it's just like, oh my God, what have we lost? It's interesting to think of it in that way. And I'm not saying that in the case of that award competition, right? Because that's already a literary moment and very protected from a lot of the basic upswells of capitalism. Mm-hmm. But I think it's hard for me as a writer to wrestle with that and to know that writing isn't the thing that's going to pay my bills. And then just that navigation as a writer of what I really want to say and what I want to do. And to your point about this book, you know, and having those questions and how do I answer them in a way that is potentially, is it about being more accessible to more people or is it about being true to what I want to do? Is there a happy medium, right? I don't know if that's something that in terms of the investigations that you're doing in Substack.
Yeah, I think about this a lot. If you're writing poetry, like to go all the way to the other example, if you're writing and publishing poetry, that is such a protected already outside of capitalism space, right? Because nobody, I mean, there are a couple of people, right? But like, if you're not Ada Limón or Maggie Smith, like you're not making, I mean, I could name probably a handful of other people, but in the United States, there are very small number of people who are actually making money writing poetry. And if there just is no option, then you have to think about things differently, right? You're not going to, like, why is anyone writing a book of poetry? It's not going to be for dollars, right? It's a very different kind of a thing, which is not to say like, there isn't still ego and all of that in it, because it's just part of, I think, art. But I think for me, that's part of what's been so interesting about having published poetry with university and independent presses. And now having published a trade nonfiction with a big five, now it is very much in the project of capitalism. And I think that, I mean, not that the book is in service of capitalism, but, you know, it's enmeshed in a way that poetry is not. And on the one hand, I was very clear about that when I was setting out on this process, right? There was part of me that had a vision of, I want the kind of book that can be sold at Barnes and Noble, right? In part because I want to be able to reach a broader audience. And I was very comfortable with trying to figure out, you know, what is the version of this book that we can sell? Which means lots of things, right? Both in terms of like, what is the book? Who am I? What is my platform? Like, what do I have the credibility and authority to write? So it's, I don't know. So it's not like you can get out of, or like I was trying to get out of capitalism, but I think there's something of trying to sell it, but also trying to make it genuinely the best book that I can. I think a lot, especially in this nonfiction memoir-y space, there's a certain kind of book that does really well, that has like a clear, zippy message, if that makes sense. It would be really great if it was like, divorce your husband, fix your life, right? That's a book that sells really well because it's like zippy and grabby. And I'm so allergic in my own life to advice. And I think this is a book that has a message, right? But it's like a much more nuanced, instead of living up to someone else's ideals, get to know what you want, build your community instead of trying to be perfect on your own, be messy and get out there and talk to other people. But that isn't as zippy and sellable maybe as some things that have been New York Times bestsellers. With nonfiction, there's such a dividing line between prescriptive nonfiction that's telling you what to do and nonfiction that is maybe more reflective and more about ideas. And I think my book is very much a book of ideas. Here are the bad ideas I had, and here's how I tried to get better ones. And I hope the reader is with me on that journey. And I mean, in some ways, it's a book about the problems with advice, right? It oftentimes isn't actually tailored to who you are and what you need. But it means that it's a messier thing to try to say what the message of it is. And maybe in some ways, it's harder to sell than if I had a like, here are the three things you should do. You know, it's like the problem of social media, right? Where like things that do really well, and we were talking about this last night, things that do really well on social media are like, here's the hack you can use to get your kid to potty train in one weekend or whatever, right? But if you're not selling that, you're like, well, actually, it's really messy and context specific. And let me tell you the history of it. Like, you know, it doesn't have the same kind of like broad appeal.
You have me laughing only because I literally last weekend was at a birthday party for my 3-year-old. And one of the other moms was talking about how horrific her very prescriptive potty training journey was with her child. And I was like, how do I share this in a way that's not offensive? Where I was like, we kind of just did potty learning and it took like a year and a half. And she was like, oh, that's just, and it was nice though, because the burden and the pressure of this idea that these constructs or these processes are one size fits all and you can do it so quick. I mean, I'm just like, life is so much messier than that. And caregiving and creative, yeah. I mean, work in that sense is also.
But it's very hard to sell like a parenting book that's like, no one really knows what's happening. Like, that's not, you can't sell that book. Maybe your kid will potty train in a weekend. Maybe it'll take a year and a half. Like, that is not a marketable product, unfortunately.
No, it isn't. It's interesting though, because as a parallel, I think there's so much in writing that writers, especially new writers, want this one size fits all framework and pedagogy of, well, this is how you do it. And if you just follow these rules, you will create the book that, and I, maybe that is the capitalist impulse to want to create efficiencies, right? Because that is really just an efficiency measure of, my kid needs to be potty trained. It better happen quick. My kid needs to sleep. I need a solution, right? Like, whatever it is. As you were talking about last night, is that every child is so different. Every relationship with that child, like your relationship, your partner's relationship, that's again where the allo-parenting thing I think is so critical, because you would be exposed to something, right? When you were talking last night, and I think maybe this was the question I was going to ask you that I forgot now that I didn't ask in the Q&A, but I was thinking about how in American society, I think, and Western society broadly, but American society very specifically compared to what I've seen in many other cultural contexts, children are so pushed out of the conversation, of the spaces, physically the spaces that we live and work and commune in, that no one is responsible then for them except for us, right? Like the individual caregivers. And I was just thinking about how everything from birth to what type of breastfeeding or not, or sleep, and all of these things that we do alone, if we were to see more spectrums of how those operate and also give our children the opportunity to engage with elders or others or peers that would have a different capability set than we as individuals have, that would solve for so many of those problems, right? But that's also not quantifiable. That's not marketable. That's not, right? Like, that's not sellable.
Yeah.
Like, how do you sell that and package that? And so we've removed all of that. It's just obvious. It's so obvious, but it's also, for me, going back to that moment with this other mother, it was like so relieving for her to hear that what she was doing, it was like, there was nothing wrong with what she was doing. It was just that she had all this pressure to perform in a certain way and to have her child perform in a certain way. And when I just said, like, oh, well, it just was like kind of messy and it was hard, but like it was also easier in some ways because we weren't putting all this pressure on the child when they weren't ready. And we just sort of navigated that she even said to me, she's like, oh, I'm going to do that with my second. Like, she's a younger child. She's like, now I know. Thank you. I really appreciate that. But it's like, we don't see it. We're not living in community enough.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is one of the blessings, actually, or I keep using that word, which feels weird. This is one, I think, of the really lucky things of having had my kids when I did, which was when we lived in Madison. We were the first of our friends to have kids, but we had really wonderful friends who would just come over and hang out with us. And in a way, I think it was lucky that they didn't. And actually, several of them continue to not have kids and continue to be like really engaged, important people in our lives and our kids' lives, which I'm so grateful for. But to have people who really cared about us, really loved our kids, got to know our kids, and were paying attention to them, I feel like could see things that were happening with them that I just couldn't see, in part because of how I was doing at that point. I was exhausted. I was not, you know, entirely well, but also just because they were a different person and they were able to notice things differently. But that really only happens when you're kind of messy with someone, right? Had I had a more organized, this is my mom and baby play date, what kind of a situation, I don't know if I would have had people in my life who would be like, oh, wow, he looks like he's super tired right now. Like, maybe he should go take a nap, you know? Or even people who would be able to think about my friend Anna, like one of the gifts that she has given me many times over the years is to be able to say, like, after they've spent a weekend with us, I could cry right now just thinking about it. One of the things that I love about you and Smith is that you do this with your kids, you know, that she's there, she's present, she's noticing things, or she's noticing things about the kids. And that's such a gift, but you only see that if you're willing to also have someone see you like mess up and be messy and maybe lose your patience or see your kid not on their perfect behavior. Like, it requires a level of messiness in the relationship that I think is very uncomfortable in our culture, where we'd rather, like, I am taking my child to the children's activity and then I am taking my child home.
Yeah, not living in the intermediate, not just the intermediary, but I think the vulnerability of home. You were mentioning, like, she's in your home. Yeah. She's seeing yeah. that private space. Yeah, it's so interesting. All right. Well, I think we could talk. We could clearly talk for hours about all of these subject matters specifically. And one thing I've been doing in this podcast season is to ask guests what, very specifically, what you've given birth to. And I know it's such like an obvious question, but maybe if you can succinctly answer that, or what that even means to you in terms of what birth is.
I don't know. We could have a whole other, like, maybe 2 or 3 hour long conversation about birth itself, because I am always, I don't know. I had 2 really amazing births that made me, as much as like the postpartum was really challenging for me, the births themselves, I felt so supported and so powerful. So, but we could talk about birth another time. I mean, I feel like right now, to kind of loop back to the very beginning of the conversation, I'm kind of trying to figure out what is the new version of myself that I am giving birth to, which feels like a very midlife kind of a thing, right? To be like, okay, my kids are, you know, old and they're 9 and 11, right? They're not grown up, but they are at a place where they don't require my constant supervision. My creative life is in a place where I've done a bunch of things that I really wanted to do. So, like, what am I doing now? Who am I now? That feels a little unsettling, but also exciting.
Well, we are here for it. I feel like I do cultivate pretty good intergenerational type of friendships. Yeah. And just spent the morning with a friend who's almost a decade older, and seeing where she is in that process, yeah. both just even from a physical hormonal perspective, yeah. but also caregiving and yeah. life and meaning and where she's aligning with what she wants at that moment was really, we had such a nice and lovely conversation about that. But I think, again, to all of these points is just how living more in community in that sense, mm-hmm. not the mom and baby group where everyone's got the same narrow focus around my kid needs to sleep and this and that, right? But really getting the long view, having those other friends be like, this isn't gonna matter. Like, all this stuff that you think yeah. matters now will yeah. not. What's the big picture mm-hmm. piece of it can be really helpful. And I think I'm grateful to this podcast community and to guests like you and to new friendships and sitting in this really messy moment of what's to come for you. So we will be there to watch. Thank you. Well, for everyone, we will include links to Nancy's book and to Nancy's Substack, and are excited for you to engage with her on those platforms as well.
I'm your host, Caitlin Salamini, and this is the Postpartum Production Podcast. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating. This will help us reach more listeners like you who are navigating the joys and pitfalls of artistic and parenting identities. For regular updates, visit our website, postpartumproduction.com. Follow us on Instagram at Postpartum Production Podcast, and subscribe to our podcast newsletter on Substack. Thank you for listening, and we are so grateful to have you with us on this journey. Postpartum may feel like forever, and sometimes it may feel very lonely, but you're not alone here.